morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Tomorrow, December 15th, is Bill of Rights Day 226. And this past Sunday, December 10th, was the 69th birthday of the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights. While the American Bill of Rights are fundamental laws of the United States, indisputably until just recently, the UN Declaration of Human Rights act more as aspiration for humanity in general, but not now as its reality. Among the most essential provisions of these documents are: all humans are born free and equal in dignity and rights. They are endowed with reason and conscience and should act toward one another in a spirit of humanhood. Everyone is entitled to all rights and freedoms without distinction of any kind, such as race, color, sex, language, religion, political or other opinions, national or social origin, property, birth, or other status. No law shall be made respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free expression thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition for a redress of grievance. Everyone has the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion. This right includes freedom to change religion or belief and freedom, either alone or in community with others, and to hold opinions without interference, and to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas through any media and regardless of frontiers. No distinction shall be made on the basis of the political, jurisdictional, or international status to which a person belongs. Everyone has the right to life, liberty, and security of person. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable search shall not be violated. No one shall be held in slavery or servitude. Slavery and the slave trade shall be prohibited in all their forms. Everyone has the right to work, to free choice of employment, to just and favorable conditions of work, and to protection against unemployment. Everyone, without any discrimination, has the right to equal pay for equal work. No person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment or indictment of a grand jury of peers, nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against themselves, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. No one shall be subjected to torture or to cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment. Everyone has the right to recognition everywhere as a person before the law. No law shall be passed granting to any citizen or class of citizens privileges or immunities which upon the same terms shall not equally belong to all citizens. Some of you who are listening might notice that these articles and amendments have been somewhat scrambled between the U.S. Bill of Rights and the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And the last provision from the Oregon State Constitution Bill of Rights just happened to slip right in. You might also have noticed that in neither document's articles or amendments that I mentioned is a provision for equal rights between men and women. The U.S. Bill of Rights neglects gender equality, and the closest the UN Human Rights gets is Article 16, in which both genders of full age, quote unquote, have a right to marry without any limitation due to race, nationality, or religion, and are entitled to equal rights as to marriage, during marriage, and at its dissolution. This article ignores same-sex marriage, which is at least finally recognized in the USA, but is bitterly opposed by its current president and ruling political party. An equal rights amendment to the Constitution has failed at least twice and seems dead on arrival for a while yet. The patent excuse has been that an equal rights amendment is unnecessary, but that male dominant rationale has been lately dumped on its head by the revealed sexual atrocities upon women by powerful men who consider themselves entitled to sexually prey upon women as virtually a divine right. This pernicious denial of human rights to women reaches all the way to the top, to President Donald Trump, who simultaneously denies and boasts about his sexual transgressions against women. Once again, the Equal Rights Amendment is being revived as a necessary legal, political, and moral protection and basic right. I wrote about the ERA for the North Coast Times Eagle and have read it on this program in the past. I think reading it again is apropos the renewed urgency of its adoption. And the Equal Rights Amendment is simply: equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. The pretense that half the human race is unequal and subordinate to the other half is a persistent malignancy. It has been chronic through history, especially in periods when muscle and force held sensitivity and intelligence in thrall. Yet the need to be equal and free is the most stubborn human hunger. It has taken centuries for women to emerge from the dominance of their male counterparts. It took almost a century for American women to gain the vote. So it should be no surprise that the Equal Rights Amendment to the U.S. Constitution will not stay dead. The ERA was last defeated on July 2, 1982, the date the nation's forefathers declared themselves free from England's tyranny and promised equality to all men in 1776. The ERA failed even though it had support of 80% of the electorate because of a handful of men in three state legislatures. Five other states, which had initially approved the measure, rescinded their votes. Those who regard women as chattel celebrated and pronounced the ERA dead. The Equal Rights Amendment has been sent to the grave more than once in the 96 years since Alice Paul wrote the amendment in 1923. On July 14, 1982, the same month as ERA's failure to be ratified on deadline, and the same day celebrated as the beginning of the French Revolution in 1789, 51 U.S. senators and 201 representatives co-sponsored the ERA in both houses of Congress. That attempt also failed. A national referendum would probably make the ERA law within a few months. Instead, when revived again, and it will be, it must once more travel the torturously long trail through the states. 38 states must ratify it, and even the most optimistic believe it will take years. One possibility to encourage the process of making the ERA a part of the Constitution is for women to vote all who oppose it from office and support only candidates who endorse it. In the words of Susan B. Anthony, there shall never be another season of silence until women have the same rights men have on this green earth. And that was something I wrote. And now, by Dr. Robert Brake, Racism, Revived, Repudiated, or Repented. Heed these stirring remarks by a legendary American athlete. Quote, "There I was, the black grandson of a slave, the son of a sharecropper, part of a historic occasion, a symbolic hero to my people. The air was sparkling. The sunlight was warm. The band struck up the national anthem. The flag billowed in the wind. It should have been a glorious moment for me as the stirring words of the national anthem poured from the stands. Perhaps it was, but then again, the anthem could be called the theme song for a drama called The Noble Experiment. Today, as I look back on that opening game of my first World Series, I must tell you that it was Mr. Rickey's drama and that I was only a principal actor. As I write this, 20 years later, I cannot stand and sing the anthem. I cannot salute the flag. I know that I am a black man in a white world. In 1972, in 1947, at my birth in 1919, I know that I never had it made." End quote. Jackie Robinson's autobiographical remarks sum up well the white man's burden with racism, still rampant, if sometimes more covert, in 2017. On September 22, 2017, Donald Trump chastised black professional athletes for kneeling during the national anthem, allegedly disrespecting the flag. Trump, the birther who earlier claimed that the race problem, and that's in quotes, was Barack Obama's doing, tossed more red meat at an audience consisting of people who seemed unaware or oblivious to the history of racism in America. Earlier, Trump suggested that many sides, and that's again a quote, shared blame for the violence in Charlottesville on August 12, 2017. Refusing to seriously condemn bigotry and hatred, he claimed that there were some very fine people among the white supremacists and neo-Nazis who confronted peaceful protesters, killing one and injuring many others. Reading off a teleprompter, Trump's denouncement of white supremacy sounded like a little boy forced to eat his spinach or rat on his friends. A short review of the place of Negroes, blacks, Afro-Americans in America makes it very clear that the problem hasn't been solved. It hasn't been wished away, and it remains a serious threat to our very divided country. Briefly consider some lessons from our past. Many whites and a good many blacks as well subscribe to an inspiring historical narrative in which the status of black Southerners is seen as a long, hard climb from the antique evil of slavery through the Jim Crow era to a series of landmark events after World War II, the 1954 Supreme Court decision rejecting the separate but equal canard, the 1955 Montgomery bus boycott, the 1957 confrontation at Little Rock High School, marking the start of the modern civil rights movement. But earlier in the 20th century, white Southerners came to embrace and defend their way of life with a set of self-serving ideological constructs adapted and promoted by landowners, mill owners, railway barons, bankers, merchants, media magnates, Democratic politicians, and Protestant clergymen. To realize their vision, it became necessary for them to pit poor whites and poor blacks against each other, making them beholden to a paternalistic white elite. At least that's one version of how the New South evolved. Along the way, it became perversely fitting that the South's colloquial term for racial oppression, Jim Crow, should be derived from a minstrel song. For it was the proliferating media of popular culture, including novels, plays, songs, films, newspapers, magazines, and commercial advertising, that played a major role in generating and disseminating the ideology of Southern racism and imprinting it upon the American mind. Revisionist historians and crackpot social scientists endorsed the prevalent racism, recasting the rise and fall of the Confederacy not as a ruinous act of treason, but as a gallant lost cause of Southern self-defense. In 1902, pulp novelist and racist propagandist Thomas Dixon wrote his first book, The Leopard's Spots, achieving bestseller status. Its 1905 sequel, The Klansmen, was a national sensation, selling more than a million copies in the 4 months following its publication, inspiring a stage play of the same name that toured the country to packed houses for years to come, and motivating filmmaker D.W. Griffith to create Birth of a Nation, a film praised by President Woodrow Wilson as history written with lightning. Birth of a Nation, Hollywood's first blockbuster, inspired a revival of the Ku Klux Klan, which claimed nearly 4 million members in 1925. Fast forward to the church bombings of the 1960s, the killing of Medgar Evers, the racist rants of George C. Wallace, the 1965 Selma, Alabama march, during which future Congressman John Lewis was beaten, and the Martin Luther King assassination in 1968. Then fast forward to the police violence in Ferguson, Missouri, numerous killings of blacks by white police officers, most exonerated, the KKK and neo-Nazi violence at Charlottesville, and Trump's rants about unpatriotic, rich black athletes, and we can conclude that rampant racism is not a thing of the past. It's a now problem that, fearfully, might achieve the status of normalcy for many Americans. When Martin Luther King was assassinated on April 4, 1968, Bobby Kennedy delivered the following remarks to a black audience in Indianapolis, remarks still relevant today. Quote, Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice between fellow human beings. In this difficult day, in this difficult time for the United States, it's perhaps well to ask what kind of nation we are and what direction we want to move in. For those of you who are black, considering the evidence that there were white people who were responsible, you can be filled with bitterness and with hatred and a desire for revenge. We can move in that direction as a country, in greater polarization, black people amongst blacks and white among whites, filled with hatred toward one another. Or we can make an effort, as Martin Luther King did, to understand and to comprehend and replace that violence, that stain of bloodshed that is spread across our land, with an effort to understand compassion and love. What we need in the United States is not division. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but love and wisdom and compassion toward one another and a feeling of justice toward those who still suffer within our country, whether they be white or whether they be black. The vast majority of white people and the vast majority of black people in this country want to live together, want to improve the quality of our life, and want justice for all human beings that abide in our land. End quote. And that was Bobby Kennedy. 63 days later, the author of those eloquent words was himself the victim of violence. So I wonder, will the racism, the hatred, and its attendant violence ever end? What will it take for Americans to come together, decrying bigotry? Can we embrace tolerance, empathy, compassion, and goodwill? Reflecting on our history of race relations and class warfare, I'm not sure we will ever heal our wounds. Donald Trump, our bigot in chief and morally sentient, emotional simpleton who doesn't have the capacity to tell right from wrong, will continue to deepen the racial divide. Pandering to public fears around race, Trump will continue to speak to the worst impulses of his audiences and embrace whatever nasty, violent visions that seem politically expedient at any given moment. So it's far beyond time for us men and women of good conscience to denounce this president, to remember the eloquent urgings of Jackie Robinson and Bobby Kennedy, and to continue our battle against bigotry. We have an urgent obligation to begin the cleanup. What's essential is that we passionately pay much more attention to the racial divide. As Heather Heyer, the 32-year-old counter-demonstrator killed at Charlottesville on August 11th, so aptly put it, if you're not outraged, you're not paying attention. And that was my Dr. Robert Brake, who lives in Ocean Park, Washington, and frequently contributes articles he has written for the Chinook Observer to this program. And now, from the Alabama Political Reporter, an article by Josh Moon. Thank you, Roy Moore. From the bottom of my heart, Roy Moore, thank you. Sometimes in America, and especially in the South, we tend to get a little complacent, a little too comfortable, almost in a daze-like state, where we're simply walking through life, accepting the world we inhabit every day for the way it is. It's sort of like, have you ever encountered a wild animal that suffered an injury, a broken limb, or some form of deformity? And to compensate for it, the animal learned to walk, stand, and run in an oddly contorted way. But because it's been living that way for so long, it doesn't realize now that something is wrong. It's just regular life for the animal. Well, that was Alabama up until the last month. A deformed state, just making its way through the day, slouched over and limping, one arm dragging, with slurred speech. And we thought, it's just the way it was. Then you came along, Roy. You hit the national stage, spewing crazy and pushing a shopping cart full of hate. And the rest of America took one look and said, hey, why is that Alabama running like that, mascot? Of course, we didn't know any better. Hell, we thought it was normal for your governor to get caught up in an affair with a 40-year younger aide, complete with publicly released sex, and then be forced to resign over campaign finance crimes at the same time as a previous governor was being released from federal prison and the current House Speaker was awaiting prison. That's just the way we lived here, with our political appendage twisted up behind our backs and slapping us backwards as we tried to move on. Up until you decided to take this Senate thing seriously, Roy, we thought it normal that in a state with record poverty, there were mega churches with gaudy furnishings, multiple pastors earning high six figures and multi-million dollar building funds. We never bothered to ask much at all about these churches and what was going on in and around them, how there were allegations of sexual harassment and misconduct at some, a guy convicted of trying to cover up child molestation gainfully employed by another, and a whole bunch that have been routinely violating tax laws by advocating for political issues or candidates. And maybe this is just a personal failing on my part, but I never truly understand just how many preachers would gleefully jump at the opportunity to blindly defend anyone credibly accused of child molestation while denigrating the alleged and apparently innocent victims. Nor did I understand just how many, or that there would even be one, preacher who would straight out justify the act of molestation. And maybe we also should have looked a bit harder at the number of churches that preach greed, that condone discrimination, that fill their congregations full of hate and anger, and that would gladly turn Jesus away for being a bleeding heart libtard. It took your campaign, Mr. Moore, to bring it to light. And that's not all. The rest of the country also got a close-up look into Alabama's ever-present race problems. It was particularly helpful when you mentioned that whole thing about America being at its best when we still had slavery because families were together. Yeah, sure, we here in Alabama knew that there were people who believed such ignorance, but this was apparently a surprise to the rest of the country. They responded by pointing out that black families often weren't together, and then they jumped to the conclusion that you and others obviously didn't even consider the plight of black Americans when looking for the golden age of America. And that mindset, of course, speaks volumes about the problems we still have with race and racism. Another revelation, thanks to you, Roy. I don't know that we'll truly understand all of the good you've done for this state until many years down the road. After changes forced by the good people of this state upon the Neanderthal voting bloc that continues to keep us down and embarrass us. After corrections are made in a desperate attempt to keep and lure businesses. After the younger generation of socially conscious, open-minded adults take hold and force out the rednecks. But a big, bright spotlight has been focused on Alabama and all of its problems over the past month, and I am more certain than ever before that the good people of Alabama are fed up and motivated to do something about the bad people of Alabama. For that, and for absolutely nothing else, I think we owe you, Roy Moore, a big thank you. And that was by Josh Moon, a columnist for the Alabama Political Reporter. His column was written this past Monday, and in light of Tuesday's election, might aptly be subtitled, Mr. Jones Goes to Washington. And as epilogue, today, December 14th, 1900, German physicist Max Planck published his quantum theory, which helped resolve previously unexplained phenomena, such as the behavior of heat in solids and the nature of light absorption on an atomic level. The combination of quantum theory with Albert Einstein's theory of relativity is the basis of modern physics. 15 years and 2 days later, on December 16th, 1915, Einstein's general theory of relativity was first published. So we have past and future. This has been Michael McCusker.